Okay, the name of this session is This Is My Body, Broken for You, Christian Faith and Domestic Violence. And we'll be getting to that subject imminently. This is the third in a series that we've entitled Violence in the Face of God, Unmasking the Tradition, which even to me now sounds like an overreaching title. But we have been examining together in the first two sessions the ways in which images of God and stories and liturgy and hymnody from our faith may serve to condone, purvey what they say to us. What are the meanings we attach to these stories, especially that have to do with violence? A lot of our Christian, a lot of the stories of biblical faith, and also some of the theological beliefs that we hold, especially around the crucifixion of Jesus, carry a language and symbol kind of system that we don't sort of step back and look at a little bit more objectively very often. It has become so much a part of our language and culture. And what we're asking is for all of us to bring a more critical eye, not in order to somehow undermine our faith tradition, but so that we might look at some of the value judgments around violence in our faith that may be carried in our faith stories and faith tradition, so that we can address issues of violence in our lives and our society. Any other question? Anything that's been sort of brewing among anyone who's come to a couple of these sessions?
No, it's just the fact that the South Sea Island people and so forth, and their religious, they had cannibalism, drinking of blood and so forth, and they look at us and say, "Hey, isn't that what Christianity does? And it's sacrifice of the body and blood of Jesus." Drinking wine, drinking bread. That just kind of goes along with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Contemporaries of the early church also raised questions about that. What are these Christians doing? We don't often examine that language to sort of see, well, wow, that eating the body and drinking the blood, that's did you have a?
Oh,
you were just moving.
Yeah, sorry.
Like attending an auction.
Sold to the woman on the first floor.
I would say that, though, right along with what you're saying, I caught last night after we finished the session, the altar, this is my body given for you. It took on a new kind of connotation, and it just in my morning scripture readings, and I'm curious if you're going to deal any more with scripture, how they use kind of these violent images that, you took the three major, themes in Christian history. Are you going to do more with how we can interact with that or reinterpret, reteach? Are you going to deal further with some of that? Those, they feel left threads to me. It's not very well.
We're not going to deal more explicitly with biblical tradition today, but before the end of the week we will be. But we are going to look again at sort of rebuilding or what sort of carry on further from where we are.
Yeah. One thing that we wanted to clarify because of some of the questions we heard circulating is, so why are we doing this? Why do we invite you, and what's the purpose of criticizing our tradition, looking in more depth, why take it apart and sort of examine these pieces? And those of you who are able to be with us in the first session caught some suggestion of that, I think. It's because of the role that Christian tradition has played in our society and in our own lives. And we do that not in order to undermine or to somehow, like for instance last night we were looking at the crucifixion, the point of looking at the meanings that human beings have attached to the crucifixion is not to somehow take away the importance of what that means to Christian communities, but to see if those interpretations are life-giving interpretations, to bring a kind of ethical concern to that. Christy and I both believe, and it's been part of our kind of theological training and upbringing, that we can only really own and hold dear those things about our faith that we've really examined if we just mouth the words in a kind of perfunctory way. Then they're not ours yet. And a part of a stage of faith development and maturation is coming to question. It's like young people do with family values. If we didn't all as youth question, even rebel at some level against what we were handed by our parents, it would never become our own. We would never sort it out. So something of what we're trying to do in this course, which is to look a little more closely spoke of unraveling and reknitting in the first session. We're trying to look at some of the threads and examine the tapestry and the texture so that we then might, you know, make it our own and weave part of our own, even add to the weaving. That's kind of a point of clarification of what the purpose of our task is.
I have something. Uh-huh. The Bible talks a lot of joyfulness in the Bible, and what I was taught in Sunday school through our singles ministry at Emmanuel Lutheran in Longview is basically you need your three things. You need your food, you need your housing, and you need your being healthy. And after that, you know, you should pretty much feel very, you know, joyful about it. I don't know where the anger would come in if you had those things.
Well, we, in our first session, tried to open our community of people gathered here to the voices of many people who, because of their life experience, have a hard time simply being joyful without bringing the anger with them. That includes many of us here. One of the subject that we broached today, domestic violence, we know, because of what we've learned about its prevalence in our society, that it is not simply a concern outside this room. And so, you know, really the concerns of how we bring, why ask questions about what the tradition means to our everyday life? Because of a concern for community. And that is some of us here already are hobbled in our ability to celebrate without any, you know, obstacle. Already, we here. So it's a concern really for the community of the church and the community of the human family. If I may be able to celebrate and have unmitigated joy, that's a wonderful thing. We want to embrace that, if that's your faith experience. But if we have a concern for our whole community, then we must bring the concerns of gay and lesbian people, of the differently abled, of victims of violence. We must bring that into our very faith community. That's what we're trying to do. We need to move to our topic for today. And what do you think?
Before we broach it, I want to be responsible for advocating your reading the books that I asked the bookstore to buy. And the one which we used pretty extensively yesterday was Christianity, Patriarchy, and Abuse, A Feminist Critique, which has been one of the most challenging books that I've read in a long time that really takes head on the question of what are the links between violence, particularly violence against women in our Christian tradition. And it also, one of the chapters is by a woman named Rita Nakashima Brock, where she posits a new sort of
focus for Christology on looking to children and the lives of children as a way to understand Christ. So, which I think is a real hopeful piece in there. So that's one book. The other book, which will make a little more sense after today, is called Touching Our Strength, The Erotic is Power and the Love of God by Carter Hayward. And I really asked folks to order this book because, well, I think it does a number of things. I think it's really good at pulling apart what's going on in society and Christianity from a liberal tradition perspective. And it has a wonderful chapter on the liberal Christian tradition and moral critique, or the lack thereof within the liberal tradition, which I found very, very helpful. Sometimes we look to a more conservative tradition because it's easier to see this, you know, it's a little more dualistic, black and white, and so it's easier to see, well, that might not work or that might be good, but it's all in our liberal tradition as well, so this book is really helpful with that. And essentially, it's helpful in, it's critical of any sort of alienated power, or power that's based in some way on violence, and gives us images and models and resources for more mutual power sharing in through her own experience and the experience of other people in the book. So I highly recommend it. As we get into the discussion today about domestic violence, I want to start off with just a little exercise. By asking, I want to admit I've done this exercise mostly in New York City, so I have usually more responses to this, but if there's anyone in the room who has ever been mugged, I assume it doesn't happen much here at Holden Village, or...
Exactly what do you mean by that?
Mugged? Like if someone's come up to you, grabbed you, and stolen your money, or your purse, or your
or
wallet.
Or physically attacked.
Yeah. In the street somewhere. Or if your house has ever been broken into, if there's anyone. Yeah, we got more hands on that.
Amen.
One.
Okay. No, but I'm raising my hand for the first one.
Okay. Okay. And if you have, I want to ask three questions about that. What did you do? Let's start just with one of them. What did you do in response to your house being broken into or being mugged? Just sort of shout the answers out here. Call the police.
Got mad.
Felt invaded. Didn't stay in the house that night. Fortunately, I wasn't there, so
fear.
I just went to somebody else's house for that night.
Right. Hmm. Fear.
My situation was kind of different because we weren't sure who was doing the breaking in. We think it was the landlord, and he was coming in a little peek at a time and using my toilet to the point where I would have to get the lights all out. So that was real weird.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get over that.
Sure. And you probably didn't know exactly what to do in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
Who? What about, another question is, who did you tell or who did you talk to about what happened?
Well, I called my insurance company.
Okay.
And then they canceled me out.
Now, did that make you joyful?
No, oh, I just found another insurance company. That's all.
All right.
Okay, back to the question here. What did folks do in response to that? Who did you tell? Sorry, who did you tell?
I was picking up a friend at the airport, so we got home, and it was the second time in about 4 months. So this time it was a lot more calm. Called the police and had beer.
What did you do?
We talked.
You talked.
Mostly about why I wasn't so angry the second time.
Okay.
Anybody else on that?
Well, actually, I travel a lot in my work, and I went to my car one night at 10:30, which is not something I do in a well-lit lot, and I was grabbed from behind, and I screamed, so I wasn't really hurt physically, and I didn't experience. It was a sexual attack, but I had to talk to the police in the local city, and their response was, don't you know better than to go out at that time?
Shame on you.
Yeah. I mean, they were there, and the answer is, yes, I do, but if you have to do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell anyone else besides the police?
Of course, I had to tell my employer. I felt like I had to tell my employer.
It was in the work parking lot or something?
No, it was, I travel in my work.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And their response was very similar too, is you have to be more careful.
Did you have any medical treatment?
Didn't need it. I didn't go for counseling either. But I had frequent for quite a while.
Offered to?
Can I get in my car with my back to the outside of it?
What about, folks mentioned a few feelings. What kind of feelings? Folks mentioned anger.
Rage.
Very strange feeling that somebody has been walking around in your house.
Violation.
That's kind of what you
thought. Yeah, and a psychic sense. I mean, it's not even having to see any physical evidence of break-in before walking in and feeling the energy and knowing that something's not right. Mm-hmm. And then an issue of having to look at ways that we like to ignore those
intuition.
I had the same experience in terms of someone breaking into the house, the sense that someone else has transgressed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a, there is some feeling
there's
of violation.
Some, yeah.
For you?
No, it's just, I haven't had this experience, but I do have that feeling right now, being in Holden Village, being away from my house, you know, it's my old, you know, your castle, and you just hate to, I hate to leave it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to leave it for a week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something that's almost as bad as I've seen phone calls. As a single woman, I had about three I've seen phone calls after my husband died.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very scary, especially when you don't expect.
We can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I almost as bad as having a seen phone call. After my husband died, I had about three the first year. None since, but and that was scary. Somebody had my phone number. Someone wanted to say some filthy things to me, and I worried, did that person know where I lived? Was it by accident? Was he coming to get me? you know, sort of creepy feelings. Is he watching me at night? You know, strange feelings when you're alone for the first time in 40 years.
I've been burglarized in my house 4 times, and I have a different reaction than everybody else. I should offer that, and I just ignore it. I mean, I went in the house, I called the police, I shoved everything back in the drawer, and I went to bed. And I guess I can do that because I always have thought that I was so glad I wasn't there when it happened. Then I know I'm okay.
I had one response that hasn't come up yet. I was once, this wasn't a mugging or a robbery, but I was accosted by a mother and her two young children in a Paris subway. And they were apparently working as a team, kind of pickpocketing people, and it was a ruse. It was hard to tell at first, and we kind of caught on to what they were trying to do. They were trying to zip open their packs and get our wallets out. And the feeling that I had, along with rage and anger afterwards, was that that was scary to me, was that that mother and her kids were not human. They were like, they were vermin. I mean, that was part of my anger. Mm. It was a real dehumanizing thing. I couldn't, in a way, forgive these people for doing this to me.
Mm. Well, I want to move on from this portion of the discussion, but the hope is really that as we look at the question of domestic violence and the question of victimization, that we have some empathy for the depth of what that is about, and it's not just something like, you know, like your experience of, well, you shouldn't have been there, but that we're able to see if something like this is happening to us, how difficult it can be to respond, and the depth of both psychological and physical, emotional, social issues that are related to that, and to bring our own experience into that. What I want to do now, and I don't have enough copies for everyone here, but maybe if you can sort of pass these out, every other person, I also have a copy, so you don't have to have it in your hand to follow. But I want to read a story of a woman that I worked with in East Harlem. And those of you, what? Can you hear me? Those of you who were at the first session heard a little bit about my work in that community. And I want to just make a little caveat that while we're reading the story of a woman who has lived in the community of East Harlem in New York City and is an African-American woman, that domestic violence does occur in all socioeconomic, racial, religious, there may be another category, but it's pervasive in all what we call categories of society. So we don't want to look at this story as, well, that's what happens in East Harlem and that wouldn't happen in my community, because the facts just don't bear that out. It's not even a higher percentage in East Harlem. So we look at this story because, particularly because I had the opportunity to talk with women there about religion and domestic violence in their lives. There's a little introduction to who Gail is, but for those of you who didn't know, I worked in the community for a number of years and became a person and a source where women could talk about their religious experiences and their experience of abuse. And there was a real need for them being able to put those two together, because it was an important connection, not in all women's lives who were experiencing abuse, but in a number. So I wanted to try and share the reading of this, so maybe I'll start out, but then we can go around if y'all can read loudly, and if someone can't hear, raise your hand. It's just a few pages long, but let's listen to Gail's story. It does start out with just a little data on who she is. Gail is a 35-year-old black woman. She was born in Harlem Hospital and has lived in New York City all her life. Her parents came to New York from the South, and she is one of seven children. Right now, the most important thing in Gail's life is getting her education to become a nurse. Her day begins at 4:30 in the morning, when she studies until 7 a.m. She does child care in her home all day with four children, and the first child comes at 7:30 a.m. She also goes to school three evenings a week, arriving home at about 10:30 at night. Gail is serious and quiet, though she is quite willing to share her deep convictions. Her religious background is varied, but for about the last 18 years, she has been a Jehovah's Witness. Gail finds great strength in her religion and is deeply committed to it. She did, however, raise certain questions about it in relation to her own circumstances of abuse, particularly in our second discussion. Gail is married and has three children. Both Patricia and Ellen are 19, and Ronald is 3 years old. Gail has experienced domestic violence in her home at different times throughout her marriage. She expressed that it seemed to get worse when she went to school and wanted to establish her own independence. Last year, Gail's daughter Ellen accused Gail's husband of sexual abuse, and he denied it. The case came to court but was thrown out because of inconsistencies in Ellen's story. Ellen is now in a drug treatment program, as she's turned to drugs after this situation surfaced. Gail has suffered greatly from this as well.
When I was growing up, my family wasn't what I wanted it to be. I think that's one reason why I tolerated as much as I did to keep the family together, because I missed that. When I was growing up, I just felt there was no discipline, and to me, there was no concern. And I didn't want my kids to miss that. So whatever it took to keep them together, I just felt it was important. I had so many friends that had mother and father and the concern, and they went to PTAs, and they had curfews and guidelines, and I didn't have any of that. I try to make it better for them.
The first church I went to was the Catholic. I was curious about the Catholic Church, so I don't know. On Sundays, I would get my girlfriends, and we would fix ourselves up, and we would just go. It didn't have too much meaning, just the fact that I was there was important. And we would go from church to church to church and just listen and observe. I got baptized as a Baptist. And after a while, it wasn't fulfilling. I just felt that I was there and I wouldn't get what I needed to go on. I would hear a sermon, and while I was there on Sunday, it felt good to sing and to hear the preacher and to be with other people. But that was the extent of it.
After Sunday, there was no more religion. And I felt I needed something for every day, not something just to go to on Sunday. Not so much being in church every day, but just something I could carry with me every day, and I didn't feel I was getting it there. Then I turned again to the TV ministry, and that wasn't it. I felt lonely in my marriage. He had his activities, and I didn't have anything to keep me occupied, and I just felt so alone, and again suicide was contemplated. I was going to just end it all. At that point, one of them, Jehovah's Witnesses, came to the door and I wasn't that interested. I had tried so many, and I said, well, the heck with it, I'm just going to give up. She was very persistent, so I just gave her the benefit of the doubt, and I just grew to like it. It's helped me to go on because, like I say, it's not just a Sunday thing, but we deal with problems that people are actually facing now. Unemployment, depression, hunger, whatever the topic might be. It's something that can get me through today and look on to tomorrow, and maybe there's some hope for next week. You know, something to go on for. There's a hope. And nowadays, without a hope, forget it.
So what do you think about God, or how would you describe or draw God? I would describe it as this force, this feeling that I get. I get a secure feeling. I get a feeling that somebody's watching over me and leading me and guiding me and protecting me, and of a person who's not going to let me go through more than I can bear. And whatever I have to go through, he's going to be there to help me through it. I just have that self-assurance. I have that confidence that he's there for me.
Do you read the Bible?
Yes,
very much so.
Why do you read the Bible?
Well, because those guidelines are there. And like I say, that's where I get my confidence. That's where I get my initiative to just go on. And I don't know. I need it. You have so much you have to face here that it's something that I need. So it's something we read every day, something we use every day. It's inspirational for me.
What have you learned from Kingdom Hall about the role of women and men in families? Basically, what they believe is that the man is the head of the house. Women are supposed to be submissive to a certain extent. He takes the lead, but it's a lead that me and him would get together and discuss. He would make most of the major decisions, but would not be without my consent. I always felt that the man should be the head of the household, if it's done in the proper way.
And in the Kingdom Hall, they strongly urge you to accept a lot of things, to try to keep the family together, to realize that nobody's perfect, that, you know, we will have our ups and downs, and as far as is possible with us, to try and keep peace and try and maintain the family relationship. They stress forgiving, and like I said, keeping that strong family relationship.
How has religion been, why even try anymore? As far as my husband and I are concerned, it takes both of us to work at it. And if it's only one side, no matter how much energy I put into it, if he's not willing to do anything, it's just not going to work. Right now I'm just really afraid because, gosh, I know this is not going to work, and I know I'm going to have to make a change, a drastic change, and I'm afraid of it. More than likely, it's just going to exclude Ronald.
I think what it boils down to is I'm going to have to pack my stuff and go. I don't even know where I'm going. I'm so scared of living alone. My girlfriend just got murdered in her apartment, and I killed her daughter too. Like I say, I always felt that a man was head of the house, and I never wanted to live by myself without one.
I think it's important for domestic violence programs to know how religion functions for women in different times. Do you think other issues are becoming important for you right now besides religion? My religion is important to me, very important to me, but a lot of things I want to accomplish in my life, they're not for. Especially like the school. They don't feel that people should continue their education. That's very important to me. They seem to feel that by me going back to school, it's not trusting in God to supply, but you got to make the first step too. I feel it's something I have to do for myself, which I'm going to do for myself. That's something that nobody can take away from me. I'm made to feel guilty because I'm considering it, but I still love my religion. I still love the teachings, and I realize I really do need them, because when I was really involved in it, even though I was having my problems, it didn't bother me as much. So I missed that peace of mind that I had. But I just can't throw myself back into it.
Women in East Harlem are encouraged to stay in abusive situations because Jehovah's Witnesses emphasize forgiving and keeping the family together. And for a lot of poor women like us, we hold those values very highly. So usually what they say, we try and apply it to our lives. I know that's what they told me, to hang in there, and hopefully, by me hanging in there and tolerating this, and still being a good religious person, this could convert him. In the meantime, I'm supposed to stay here and tolerate all this battering. That's encouraged, to forgive and to tolerate it. And for a lot of women, what the minister says is like gold. And even in my congregation, I have no grounds for divorce because they consider everything that Ronald has done to me to be misconduct.
Although in the law, I could get a divorce.
Can you talk louder?
Although in the law, I could get a divorce. According to them, it wouldn't be accepted. So I want to be accepted in the religion, so I go with what they say. So it does have a big influence on a lot of our lives. Even in the Catholic Church, they don't stress divorce. And so whatever you go through, you stay there and you say, God is watching, and in time things is going to change. And he's going to do this, and he's going to make things right. You tolerate all this mess. One of the reasons that I tolerated so much, my children, I wanted to keep my family together because they stress the importance of the family and being so forgiving. That's how I base my decisions, tolerating, and in times God's going to change things.
But then I remember the minister speaking about long suffering and how much you had to endure and stuff. At that particular point, I just got up and started crying because I said to myself, exactly how much do I have to endure and how much do I have to suffer with this man? After all these years and no progress, no change, how much suffering must I go through? In any kind of situation, it seems you always have to be suffering. If you're not suffering anything, then you're not going through nothing. It can't always be good. You're suffering, you're going through a test, and that's going to build up your faith. That's emphasized. And at one point, I just thought, my goodness, if I'm not suffering, then my goodness, God is not with me. That's the way my life has to be. I have to always be suffering. That's not true. That's not true. I'm not going to always be suffering.
So now I don't center too much on everybody else where I used to try to satisfy everybody else. I still have my religion, and like I said, my education is important, and my children is important, and my home is important, and I try to give as much of myself to them and those things as I possibly can. But now, for the first time, I'm taking my own feelings into consideration and doing some of the things that I want to do. Things that used to bother me so bad, it just doesn't bother me that bad anymore, because now I'm making Gail happy for the first time. So we just take it a day at a time. I realized I was living for him and pleasing him, and look what I got. So now it's time. I'm not going to let my happiness depend on somebody else, because if they're not there, I'm not happy, so it has to depend on me. And one thing with my relationship with God, nobody can take that away. He'll always be there for me. So that's the person I can stay close with. And whatever happens, I know I tried. I won't blame myself for any of this. And I had started to, but I won't. It's not my fault, because I gave everything that I could give, and there's nothing else that I can give. And if it doesn't work, it's not my fault. We can do what we can do, and we can't do any more.
I know that that's a powerful piece to listen to. And I guess I just wanted to start off with what you think about when you hear it, and what kind of responses you have to hearing it. What strikes you about her story?
Her deep devotion and her
high intelligence.
Did y'all hear that?
Her deep devotion to God and her high intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And what in the story leads you to respond that?
Well, she has really thought things through. She's gone through phases where she felt, well, she had to stay. She had to do everything because the church told her. The Catholic Church and Jehovah's Witnesses told her she must do this, that it was important to keep the family together and to maintain the home. And she came around to the conclusion that that she wanted to maintain the home and care for the children, and that she could have her love for God, and God would continue to love her no matter what. But she did not need to continue to put up with the battering, and that also she needed an education.
What other?
She's still in the situation, though, isn't she?
At the end of the story, she is. Yes.
She's still in it. So I'm hearing some of that resolve and clarity, but I'm wondering, is it really going to go anywhere? I mean, she could have been talking the same way 5 years ago, and we don't know that. So I hear some ambivalence also, because she seems to still be there.
I mean, she's trying to justify leaving. I'm reading in the last few lines that she's talking a good story, but I'm wondering if underneath, by just saying, and if it doesn't work, it's not my fault. There's a guilt thing in there already working, in terms of, I think she's trying to convince herself.
Convince herself over against what?
Convince herself to leave. I mean, I'm wondering how, you know, how, if she's able to follow this, if she really is as strong as she's coming through in the end.
And what types of things do you think would keep her from being able to do that?
One, she doesn't want to live alone. She's fear of the unknown. That's always, it's like in any kind of situation, a friend who's married to an alcoholic for years. This is a rotten situation she's in, but she knows what this situation is. Out here, she doesn't know. So the fear, and even though she, you know, maybe she's breaking away from this church and going again to another one, but if the church's teachings are such as put forth in here, if that comes back to haunt her, or, you know, continually she's thinking that, you know, she's going against the church's teaching perhaps by leaving. So she has a few things.
I say plus it's a financial concern too, because most women who get divorced end up in poverty.
Exactly.
And if she has children, they're all going to suffer greatly.
Exactly.
So even a bad husband is better than no husband in a financial sense.
Yeah. Particularly in East Harlem.
Mm-hmm. And related to that scripture, like, it might be an issue of pride too. Whether or not you invest a certain amount of yourself in a tradition, even if you eventually leave that tradition, you don't leave it cleanly and happily. You leave it saying, "Oh, geez, I screwed up again." Mm-hmm. So maybe that's another thing you can do. True for me.
My response is partly to be angry with the her church, that they're saying to her, "Hang in there, forgive," and not giving her support to take care of herself and to keep herself physically safe, to encourage her to maintain the risk.
I had some of those same feelings. It's almost like reading between the lines, it's almost like the church is condoning the abuse, because they're not supporting her in saying, you can do something about this, you don't have to put up with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by not working with her, yeah. It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Verla.
It seems like you get the feeling that everybody wants you to be normal, but then everybody kind of stands in your way, you know, when you try. Because it doesn't seem like it's just the church that's keeping her from, mm-hmm. you know, it's her husband, it's the safety issue. Mm-hmm. She didn't go into it, but I'm sure it's, you know, the taxes, the rent. You know, there's a lot of things that would keep her from moving out and living alone, not to mention what the neighbors would say, what the kids would tease the other kids about, you know, on and on.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by normal?
Yeah.
Well, I mean by normal what, you know, the normal American lifestyle, the Leave It to Beaver stuff. I mean, it's not normal. We all know that. But that's what's presented to us. That's the way our tax system is set up. That's the way everything is set up in that way.
That there's this vision of two parents, two right. kids living mm-hmm. happily ever after. Yeah. And if right. you're going to try and break out of that, you're going to face ostracization in a number of places.
And she said in the first page that it was really, you know, because of the things that she didn't have, it was very important to her. So it's almost like at almost all costs you, you know, try to keep this together because that's so much what she wanted.
And,
maybe
understandable.
Maybe
she got married pretty young. She has an 18-year-old and a 19-year-old, and she's 35. And she's been in that situation for a long time. And the history, one thing that she doesn't talk about is if he is abusive, how abusive would he be if she left him? Did he seek her out and find her?
There's that very real physical threat. Exactly. Which, and there are, I mean, there is more to the story. There were a number of times where he left the house and would come back and essentially do exactly that. So,
yeah. I was curious about the part of the story when she talked about going from church to church, crying Roman Catholic, and then whatever other varieties she tried. And I mean, she was talking about a need for a message related to life. I mean, that was what she was talking about. But didn't she hear the same idea about staying in the marriage and staying in the family in all those other churches? I mean, I'm sure she must have. It's not as if she finally heard that only with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, I mean, I think she stressed that because that was where she was feeling authority at the moment, was in terms of her decision to leave, was that Jehovah's Witness had authority in her life and their teachings had authority in her life at the moment. So that's what she would have to, you know, go against if she were going to get out of the relationship. But yeah, I don't think she's saying that she didn't hear it in the other places. I think what's interesting, I certainly came to respect something of what Jehovah's Witnesses offer, particularly in poor communities, as I heard her story. Because if you look at the lack of social resources, other resources she has for survival in her life, and she's saying they came in and said, you know, we'll talk about these issues that are important to you. And whatever critique I may bring about how they do that, they were offering her something that otherwise she faced a vacuum and was facing alone.
But I don't know if you all hear what I think I hear. In sort of her odyssey, religious odyssey, is that, I mean, the internal faith conflict that she is in on top of the life, direct life conflict that's all tied up together, that maybe her journey from church to church, whether conscious or unconscious, is to hear something different. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of the hope that in this next church I go to, they won't just tell me to suffer long and to bear up and that to do what Jesus did. And this puts her on top of already being an intolerable life conflict and situation. You know, it means that now she's in an intolerable faith conflict, because in order to be a good Christian mother and homemaker and and even a good, I mean, and then it gets overlaid with this stuff Verlaine was talking about, to be a good American woman, you know, motherhood and apple pie and the whole thing. I mean, it's just the layers of pressure on her individual choice. And, you know, so I also kind of feel in pain about the church adding, or churches in this case, adding layers of burden. Yeah.
Along that line, it's easy for us to dismiss this as Jehovah's Witness, but it hasn't been but a generation since most of our mainline churches absolutized Jesus' words about divorce and therefore outlawed it. Mm-hmm. And even when we got so-called liberal on the question, it's still something we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. We don't really help people see that this is an option.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't know how long it's been going on, but I know in our county we have a chaplain's office through the county sheriff's office, and they have an office downtown for women that are going through domestic violence or having problems and reaching this. I haven't actually been in there, but I don't know how they resolve the laws legally and Christianity and so forth of leaving. They have a woman's abuse home there, and there's always cars out in front, you know, for women coming and going and staying there for weeks or so. But I assume that they're working.
There's about 50 women that stay in one room that looks like an old Salvation Army building, without old donated clothing and old bedding and old sleeper sofas, and it's torn apart. It's really miserable.
I think Gail raises up in her story the question of having to leave her home. And in some sense, why should she have to leave her home?
The domestic abuse center in Everett is also barred with windows that have been broken out because there have been former mates that have tried to get back to.
What about her discussion of suffering in here at the end and what she heard about suffering and her personal decisions about that meaning? What struck you about that?
Well, she felt like she had to suffer because Christ suffered, and that it would be better for her, and that if she didn't suffer, that she wouldn't, maybe she'd be forgotten even by God, perhaps.
Did y'all hear that? That she felt like she had to suffer because Christ suffered, and that if she didn't suffer, that she might even be forgotten by God. That
there was a test.
A test. She said about the test. Mm-hmm.
But she's also come into a sense that this isn't right. I mean, it's all of a sudden it's like she's. I mean, I think the struggle is still going on, but the sense of I'm supposed to suffer, but how much am I supposed to suffer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what do you think is a critical piece in her bringing that question to it? I mean, what is allowing her to question the authority of that teaching?
I think it's just a basic survival, a real concern that I need to make another choice or die. Mm-hmm.
Is her own experience somehow comes into major conflict with that teaching, that her life is at risk because of that teaching, so something's wrong.
Right, so it gets to the point that you either follow your experience and your gut instincts, or you follow that faith that's supposed to lead you through your life experiences, and which do you choose?
And I don't think all of us are faced with the level of choice that she is faced with here, but I think that there are smaller ways in which we're also asked to look at our own experience versus teaching, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to look at this story, because she very courageously is doing that here.
There's
something. Well, it's hinted at here, but at places. And I guess it's one of the points that you know, I think as faith community we need to confront, which is how mainline denomination, the church, has used the whole notion of patriarchy as the established order, as as a mode that has encouraged violence of men against women, men against children. It's still a real, you know, dominant theme in a lot of our churches. And some recent research, still about 25% of Christian ministers would say that there was no reason that would ever justify a woman leaving her husband. And it strikes me that comes out of that whole patriarchal tradition that has been handed down to us for 3,000 years.
I think you put your finger on the issue of power in this story. And one of the things that is sort of, although this is a very, in many ways, sobering and sad story, part of what, for me, in it is the hopeful little piece, is that apparently in Gail's life, power has rested outside of her in all of this. You know, the authority of the church the power of which her husband has in terms of economy, decision-making, et cetera, and what is embryonic but real in her story, and that you kind of, you know, it sort of gives you a sense of, oh, maybe there's something here to hold on to, although it's not certain yet, is that there seems to be, she's in maybe early process of claiming her own power.
But is the church helping that? It seems to me that you know what the church typically says is that the woman's role is to be submissive,
enduring all things, including violence at times, rather than to leave the situation.
Yeah.
Well, this is true for the Jehovah's Witness Church and the Catholic Church that she's reported. On the other hand, I assume you were interviewing her, and in a sense, representing the church in a different face. No, I mean helping her to hear her own story.
Right.
I mean, so the church, right. Who is the church? You are the church, right. As much as right. Jehovah's Witness,
right.
So there's the church.
I'm speaking.
So there's,
right,
but I want to honor what positive can come from the church also.
And one other point I want to make that often happens is while we may no longer or not very often go to a church and hear someone say it's women's role to be silent in church and women should be submissive to men, I've had the experience a number of times of talking about domestic violence in churches or preaching, and the pastor will say, you know, well we don't have, you know, we should talk about this, but we don't have that in here, you know. And that's a problem out there, so we should talk about it, but we don't have that in here. And then after it's actually talked about, a number of women come forth and say, that's been my experience, that is my experience now. And so by not saying anything, not only by what we do say, but by what we don't say, we're leaving people to their own resources.
Experience that in my church in terms of talking about incest and sexual abuse, and bringing that out to the open, blew my mind how many women came up afterwards and said, I experienced that as a child.
One in four.
Never.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, for me, this story is just incredibly sad. The idea that she can still be thinking about, well, you know, the church says that the man should be the head of the household, and I believe that, even though I give my consent after, you know, what could it be 20 years of abuse, to me is mind-boggling, and is just testament to what I see as the brainwashing. You know, we look at cults and, you know, say how bad they are and how they're, you know, taking over people's minds, but, you know, I think the mainline churches have done the same thing to women.
And perhaps while we wish it were just Gail or just a few people,
right.
it's really quite pervasive. Right.
Well, you know, they've also done it to men.
Right,
too.
But women are the ones bearing the brunt of the violence.
Yeah, one thing I do like to point out that while I would never make the case and any act of violence against anyone is to be abhorred and to be looked at for what it is, there is a consistent social pattern of violence against women that I'd like to name for what it is as well, but don't want to exclude other.
I want to be quick. Now you're talking about brainwashing, I agree to an extent, but I also think that there are people who are really looking, that there are people whose need is much greater. I don't feel, I'm pretty secure. I have a lot of the things I need, you know, that kind of stuff, and maybe I'm not as desperate, and maybe I don't hang on to things longer than I need to. I don't need to address this. But that there's maybe the greater our need is, the more voices we look for, and the harder we hold on to one that we find that works for us for a while, and we don't shuck it just because it doesn't work. We don't shuck it until we find something that does work. And maybe when my needs are met, some of my more basic needs, I have more time to cast about and find other things. I'm just uncomfortable with the term brainwashing because I think that's too easy to dismiss as kind of a fantastic theory. You know, I think the ends are the same. I'm not sure about the means.
Can I describe it as a manipulating type power that masks the issue?
Mm-hmm. I think that's helpful. Yeah, let's go here, and we're going to have to close pretty soon, but go ahead.
I just wanted to say something about the ending. To me, it does have a hopefulness in it, in that it sounds like she is beginning to feel God as
something separate from just these religions that she's been searching for, and that she's beginning to feel that God will be there, even if she does have to go against what the religion tells her she has to go against. And I think that that is something that for her can be and hopefully will be empowering, that she feels God there, even if she does have to be by herself without her husband and without her.
And the church can learn from her story, too, so that if at one point the church is unhelpful, and again, using that too broadly, the church can become helpful. It's not that because the church has done this in the past, it doesn't have a choice, you know, so that awareness can lead to a church.
Church can also learn from her experience with the Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, while we may disagree with, you know, that style of faith, what she responded to was relationship. And in addressing her problems and in empowering her to move out on her own, she needs that same kind of empowering relationship and community from the church.
I think it's quite possible that the church, while being silent about abuse toward women, has been possibly even more silent about abuse toward children, and has almost defended it in the name of discipline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important.
Yeah. I'm just going to say this: the one paragraph we've almost totally ignored is the paragraph about Gail's daughter.
You've got to speak up. You're not just okay, talking I'm to sorry. You, but you're talking to all of us.
Okay. One paragraph that's almost been ignored is Gail's daughter Ellen complained that her father abused her, and this was thrown out because of inconsistencies in Ellen's story. We've almost ignored that, you know, again, abuse toward the daughter, and the court, no one would believe her story, and so the poor girl's on drugs today.
And I think, you know...
But do we really know that Ellen's story is the truth? Maybe Ellen, with all this other stuff going on, is really not too stable.
Well, I don't think we want to get into that after 11:30 here, but I would point out that there's not much incentive for someone to lie about something like that. There's not much to be gained by lying about it. And to also point out that if we're talking about how Gail is trying to find some power in her own life, a child has even less power than an adult has in that situation. A child is dependent upon even more these adults in their lives. So to think about that.
Okay.